Hey Zach, how you doing today?
Ken, in this world there is light and there is dark. I am all that is dark. I am dead inside. I don't get enough sleep, ever. Last night I got 3 hours of sleep. I stared at the ceiling, wondering about myself, my life, everything else. This morning when I went to work, I wondered, would I have a good day today? And you know what? I was stood in front of a camera and whipped to speak lines. I now turn to you, Ken, recording this podcast late at night, where, once again, I will lose a bit more of my sanity in not getting enough sleep. How are you?
Zach, that's like the saddest thing I ever heard.
Huh? What? What just happened? I didn't say anything. I don't know what you're talking about.
We should, like, get you in a support group or a home or something.
You know, Ken, you know what would make me really happy? I would love to learn about communication security.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That would make me a very happy man. That would turn me, it would turn me right around.
Zach, you are, like, to the point. I like it. What do your lizards say about your insomnia?
They whisper things to me. They keep me up at night. They tell me to buy them more clothing of a certain type.
Don't Google for that, folks. So this is episode 11, yet another prime number. For those of us who like to think about such things. So today we're going to, Zach, what do you call those like things? You call them a segue, right? Where you subtly switch from one topic to another.
Yeah, segue.
Yeah.
Very subtle. You wouldn't notice.
Yeah. You're about as subtle as the Berlin Wall. So it's you know, it's good. So, I'm excited. We all talk to people over certain, communication means. There's some that are better than others. If we're focused on privacy, there's some choices. If we're focused on just working, there might be other choices too. Of course, we're going to put on our tinfoil hat and dig into that a little bit. Before we get started, I want to talk, follow up with our last week's episode on breaches. And so I want to talk a little bit about Equifax. So if you don't read Brian Krebs' blog, it's called Krebs on Security, I suggest you do so. And there was an article published on September 8th, just last week, and it's entitled Equifax Breach Response Turns Dumpster Fire, right? And that's one of my favorite phrases, so it caught my eye. And I think that Equifax is going to provide a great case study on what not to do when, like, 100 million of your customers get owned. Once we all get hacked and work our way through that, I think this is going to be an interesting experience. We looked at some interesting, there's some interesting stuff that happened. First, it looks like they hired a PR firm, which is a good thing. I don't think they did a great job, but they did hire a PR firm to help manage the story. They brought in some outside help, a security forensic firm. Some of them were kind of interesting. They actually, one of the reasons they got caught is they got caught buying domains that could be used for spoofing. A guy bought this domain called equihacks.com, and he was part of the security company there. So that kind of got disclosed. And typically, you don't want that kind of information out there. It just muddies the message. Three top executives at Equifax sold millions of dollars of stock during the time after they found it, but before they disclosed it. So I'm not sure how that's good. There was some confusion over the whole class action lawsuit and your ability to join a class action suit if you accepted their free gift of credit monitoring tools. So that was kind of shady.
Oh.
There's some interesting stuff. They actually, this is crazy, they actually started using the Equifax breach hashtag on Twitter to sell their own credit, like, lock ID protection service. And I was like, I don't know about that. So, you know, it's possible they're actually profiting on this issue to some extent. So I'm sure they're still going to lose money, you know, in the long run by far, but, it's interesting stuff. Now I will say they have, addressed some of these concerns. One of the other really big, annoyances was it was really vague. I think we talked about it on last week's show, like whether or not you were actually affected by the breach. And so, like, I think when we checked, it just gave us a date at which we could sign up for their credit monitoring tool instead of confirming that you weren't part of it. And so they've addressed that a little bit. They're a little bit more verbose. There's also reports that you could put in random information. So, like, you know, the last six of your social, you could put, like, six nines and then make up some name. And it would randomly tell you whether or not you were hacked or not. So that's not probably the most, you know, reassuring sort of campaign there. The good news is my wife isn't hacked, so I was pretty impressed with that. So only one of us are gonna get screwed. So
wow,
I'm happy like that. So we talked briefly of what you could do. I just want to reiterate my recommendation: credit monitoring services are fine. But they're detective control, right? So they are a means by which to learn if you have been owned. They don't really do anything to prevent it. Excuse me. There are some tools that you can get, like credit alert, where they're supposed to call you if someone tries to use your credit. That's not, like, required. There's no system for that. You're relying upon, you know, the clerk at Macy's, you know, following instructions when they're trying to fill out the, you know, credit card application to actually notify somebody that this card's been flagged or whatever. And they may even have an incentive not to. So that isn't really a reasonable option, in my opinion. So really, your only option is to do a credit card or credit freeze at each of the four major credit card bureaus or credit bureaus. And that costs you some money, and it's a huge pain in the butt. Like, if you decide to get caught by a car or get a house or whatever, you're going to have them thawed. Typically, it has to be done in advance. It's not a great solution, but it's pretty much the only one we have. I think at this point, we would need to think long and hard about how we view credit and credit agencies, and to think that this company has all this information on us that, like, I never explicitly gave them, right? Maybe they got it through a bank, maybe they got it through some other means, but I mean, I'm not their customer, right? But yet my data was the one that was breached. I think there's going to be some really hard questions there.
Oh yeah.
So I know already down in some of the developing regions of the world, they're using different tools. They're using things like cell phone bills to assess credit worthiness. And so they can tell with a very high degree of certainty what your, by your cell phone, by your phone habits, like how you pay your bill, how low do you let get your, like, you know, minute balance down, like how careful you are to, you know, not get suckered into, you know, overages and stuff like that. They can tell with a high degree of certainty, you know, what your credit risk is. So there may be some other tools that are less risky than knowing all of our information, you know. So, you know, as we talked a little bit earlier, this isn't a breach like a credit card breach where you can just go get a new card. Your social security number is going to stay the same. So this is something you got to deal with. Just assume it's out there and act accordingly.
Whew, are there any, Ken, just to kind of get like a good layout of my options, are there any good places or guides that you've come across that, you know, would be good places to go to, like a website that maybe has like a good guideline to follow? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, do this.
Yeah, so I'd recommend two. The first one's a little bit more, I guess I would call it, you know, marketed towards your average person. And that would be like a site like TheVerge.com. They had some interesting steps on that. Lifehacker.com. That sometimes has some interesting content on it, so just be aware of that. But they have some good steps that you could take. If you listen to this podcast, you're probably a little on the nerd side, so I would recommend Brian Krebs' blog, Krebs on Security. And he has a long FAQ on this and has some more details on actually what your risks are. he strongly advocates for credit freezes rather than monitoring tools. It's largely what this discussion has been based off of. So full disclosure there. I'd recommend you read up on that. Most importantly, though, I mean, you just got to realize this is going to be a pain in the butt. And it's not something that's going to go away very easily.
Do you think it's possible that the government might step in and go, hey, guess what? You get a new Social Security, and you get another new Social Security, and you get a new SSN. Like, do you think that's really far-fetched?
I would guess not. Now, I mean, here's the other interesting thing, though. Like, Social Security numbers shouldn't, like, be secret.
Yeah.
I mean, the only reason it's a secret is because it's largely been, like, stolen by the credit agencies as a unique identifier, right? That wasn't the intention.
No.
Of the Social Security number. No, the Social Security number is a unique identifier. It's like your driver's license number. So, I mean, the only reason it's so secretive is because people with the Social Security number and your date of birth, they can, apply for credit in your name. There's really nothing else they can do. I mean, I guess they could file your taxes. There is that, like, mechanism of tax fraud where you file somebody's tax refund before they do, and then you get their refund. There's that too, I guess. But really, it comes down to these unique identifiers that they use for tracking your Social Security insurance, right? And so the system that was set up, in the 30s, in the midst of the Depression, is not really set up for a modern-day digital economy that's all based heavily on credit. So there's some, interesting pieces at play there. So, yeah. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. It's not a good solution. One of the problems with being in the United States is that we had a lot of advances in our economy early on. And so if you look at, like, the situation we're in with, like, credit cards, for example, yeah, we have the chips and those really crappy readers that buzz at you when you're doing things correctly. But part of that's done is because part of that reason is that we're such early adopters. We drove that technology. And so we live with these legacy solutions where countries who adopted it later, were better able to innovate. So there's probably better solutions out there. I don't know if the American public is going to be willing to tolerate a, like, national ID card or some sort of registration system. I mean, that's a whole nother can of worms. But that's really your only other alternative. They need to be able to tell, like, you, apart from all the other lizard-loving Zacks in the country.
And there are many.
And it's just, there's at least a half dozen of you, I'm sure. There's not a tool to do that other than the SSN. So, I don't know. It's an interesting piece. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, guess we'll see.
So, so that's follow-up. Be careful out there. It's rough. All right. So, today we're going to talk about secure communication. So, and this is like, this topic is pretty broad. We talked about cryptography in the past, and that's a fundamental part of all of this. There's also some, methods of, I guess you'd call it obscurity, right? You could certainly try to hide your information, make it less interesting. That's another, sort of approach. You can even go as far as steganography, right? Where you embed information into another format and hope it passes through. Like things like, implementing like a micro dot. Like they used to do in, like, the spy days in this, the Cold War. There's even some programs that allow you to hide information in images. And so if you know how to look for it in the image itself, in the JPEG itself, for example, you can pull out some text, but it's indecipherable from somebody who doesn't know what they're looking for. That's more of a hidden versus a, encryption, but there's tools out there. But we want to talk about stuff that's a little bit more accessible than that. During our cryptography show, we discussed the one-time number pad and how that provides perfect secrecy if used correctly. And if it doesn't, if you don't use it successfully, you might end up in the electric chair like Julius and, was it Edel? Julius and Edel Rosenberg?
Yeah, something like that.
So, something like that. So you don't want to, I wouldn't recommend that route. But there's some, you know, there are some options out there, but that's not easily attainable by mere mortals. So, yeah. So I don't know what the most common form of digital communication is these days. So it could be something like text. It could be something like IM. It could be something like email. Email is, you know, the legacy system we've had for the longest time. So I guess we'll start there, you know. If there's anything we can communicate in this one podcast, like sometimes I try to take, you know, provide a takeaway, a key point. It's that email is not secure. Like, by definition, email is not secure. It first originated, like, in the 1960s, and it hasn't changed all that much. There's certain clients, like Gmail. Gmail really isn't, in my opinion, isn't even mail. It doesn't even use the same, like, protocols as the others. And so that's, you know, can be problematic at times. But they modify it to allow it work with other providers. But it's kind of its own thing. So there have been some innovations in email, but typically it's not targeted towards this concept of secure messaging. So email poses a lot of problems. First and foremost, it's usually sent in the clear, right? If you're lucky, it'll be sent from your computer to your email server, and then to your recipient's email server, and then to their computer in some form of encryption. But once it hits their computer, typically it's just stored as plain text, right? And so if that person's computer is not encrypted, like, there's a vulnerability there. It's also spoofable. So there's certain means, if you're not using TLS encryption that's uses signed certificates that are trusted, you can fall to victims to what's called man-in-the-middle attacks. And so if I'm trying to email you, Zach, you know, Chad could stand in the middle and intercept our messages and read them, or worst case scenario, actually change them. Ooh. And alter the integrity of what we're trying to say, right? So there's often not means of what they call non-repudiation, or we don't have the ability for me to prove that that was actually what you said. Now, there's certain exceptions to this. So one of the first forms is, like, email, you can basically send anything. So I could, like, if you and I were to establish a one-time number pad system, I could write you emails that I encrypted with the one-time number pad. And yeah, of course that would be secure, right? It would be perfect secrecy, assuming we followed all the other steps. There's also services you can get out there. So what probably the most famous one is a company called LavaBit.
LavaBit, what?
LavaBit.
What is LavaBit?
So LavaBit is an interesting story because it brings in this guy by the name of Edward Snowden into the conversation.
Who is Edward Snowden? Edward Snowden. I'm a millennial. I don't know any of these things.
Edward Snowden was a gentleman who stole a lot of NSA information and leaked it to the press, starting in, like, 2013, 2014. It's probably the most damaging leak in U.S. history, at least for electronic, surveillance perspective.
Ken, this all sounds really complicated and sounds like it takes a lot of thought. Ken, once again, I am of a younger generation, and this is too much for me. Can you break it down to simpler terms?
Yeah, that's the millennial in you. So, So Edward Snowden worked for the National Security Agency, and there's a great movement out there called Snowden. I don't know. I thought it was interesting. I'm not sure how truthful it is, but, you know, give it a watch if you want to have some context for it. He became aware that the United States was collecting a lot of information, and it wasn't just on people who we probably should be spying on, it was pretty much on everyone. And so they had certain programs that were designed to intercept communications and aggregate this data into systems that could be easily searched and easily indexed and used for, you know, nefarious purposes. Now, the NSA is technically not allowed to spy on American citizens, right? That's kind of the realm of the FBI. Citizens do get caught up in this. Now, are they innocent citizens? I mean, that's kind of debatable. I'm sure there's some, but most of the people in there, you know, they're doing something to draw attention. You know, the potential for abuse of power is there, and so that's why it's a fairly big story. So Edward Snowden, when he first started this whole discussion, and if you watch the movie or kind of talk, read, or hear, listen to some of his talks, he kind of talks about his evolution. You know, he really started out as a true, like, American believing patriot. He was very talented. He was recruited by the agency, and they came in, and they really trained him, and he did some good. But slowly, he became disillusioned. And he ended up sneaking out a ton of data. He flew to Hong Kong, and he met with these reporters, and they began to release it. And they've actually been quite effective at keeping the story fresh. And it's shut down a lot. It's increased scrutiny on a lot of our government programs. Now, he does have some criticism, rightfully so, that a lot of this information he disclosed was, he disclosed to our enemies and allowed them to change their communication strategy to prevent the United States from being able to intercept. But at the same time, he also brought up some important civil issues. We don't talk about politics on the show. So we'll just say, like, there's the strong opinions on both sides. Right now he's in Russia. I don't think he probably has all that great of a life. From a personal level, I kind of feel bad for him. On a technical level, like I said, there's some interesting dynamics there. So one thing that Edward Snowden did when he first smuggled that information out in the movie, he did it in a Rubik's cube, which I think is fascinating. I don't know if that's actually how he did it. He won't confirm. He said that's a means by which you might be able to. When he met with these journalists, the first thing he made them do is he's made them set up encryption on their laptops so they could communicate with him securely. And he was a little bit paranoid. He wouldn't talk to them unless they set up, public key cryptography on their email. So in our encryption show, we talked a lot about public key cryptography. We also called it asymmetric cryptography. It's a means by which I don't have to share a secret with you in order to communicate securely with you. I wanted to send a message to you, I would encrypt it with your public key, I would send the message to you, and then you would unlock it with your private key. And assuming that was done correctly, it's a very secure means of communication. It relies upon the difficulty of factoring semi-primes, which are the product of two very large prime numbers, right? So we talked about that. That's one of the fundamental tools that you use in this. There's software such as OpenPGP. It's software you put in your computer. You establish a key, and a private key and a public key. The public key is published in what you'd call like a key directory, and that tries to ease that whole key sharing process. And so if you and I, Zach, were in the same key directory, I could just type in your email and choose to send it securely, encrypted with OpenPGP, and it would grab your public key, encrypt the email for me, and send it directly to you. When you received it, assuming you had the same software installed, it would take your private key, which it knows, it would prompt you for a password to unlock it, and they would decrypt the email.
Hmm. Okay.
So that is a seamless way of doing secure email.
Seems
now, the
simple.
Trouble is, well, yeah, that's where it is, but you have to think about it. You have to like really get involved and understand what it takes to set up that email or to set up that system, right? And so for your average person, they're not going to be able to do it. And so that's why email becomes a difficult challenge. There's not just like a turnkey solution for it. So LavaBit was an attempt at this. LavaBit was a mechanism. To send email in an encrypted format. So,
that's weird. I've never heard about it before. Where did it come from?
Well, it was started by just a guy in Texas, and he was kind of concerned about the security of some other common, just like free email services, and so he spun up this company. And he offered asymmetric encryption, and he himself didn't have access to. He kept some means of security and privacy for his users to the point where he couldn't access at least some of their information. And so this really got brought to light is in the midst of that Snowden investigation, they came to him and they demanded the encryption keys to access whatever they could on Snowden. And he tried to play it loose with the feds, and they ended up cracking down on him. One of my favorite things he did, so he has this like ridiculously long key, right? To protect, I mean, his private key is huge, right? They're massive. That's one of the problems with asymmetric encryption. It requires very, very large keys to provide security. And what he actually did is when they subpoenaed him for that, he actually printed it out on like paper in very small font and gave it to him, right? And they said like, okay, look, like, he's like, look, I'm complying with the order. But I mean, it was like pages of like just the, you know, random characters that he would have to enter. And that pissed the feds off, and so they came back to him, and it actually made it worse for him. They made him give, like, all the keys up, and they provided him with, like, a national security letter, and, I mean, it was a nasty situation.
Ooh, wow.
And so he ended up being shut down in August of 2013. So,
Well, that's kind of a shame.
He wasn't even, like, allowed to talk about it. So that's kind of the interesting situation. And he was actually even under, potentially was going to be arrested for shutting down his business. I think one thing that people don't realize is that the government is given tremendous power to procure these materials, right? And there's actually a part of the Constitution is called the All Writs Act. And it basically allows the government to compel anybody to do anything. It's a very broad power. It's what they tried to get Apple to provide a means of decryption or a means of accessing that San Bernardino terrorist. And that's what Apple fought in court. And it was subsequently dropped. So anyway, so there are all these like secure email tools. Lavabit shut down rather than to compromise the security of their users. They just said, nope. There's another one called Proton Mail. Proton Mail is kind of cool. It's developed by the folks who are from CERN and who did like the Large Hadron Collider. And so it's a means of encryption. They have a zero access to user data policy. So, and that's one of the hallmarks of a truly secure system. So if you were to lose your password, you're screwed and you're not going to get it back. So that's kind of a double-edged sword. Of course, like that means your data is secure. They can't give it to you, but it also means you're not going to get it back either. So Proton Mail is kind of a hybrid solution. So you can email other people, but like within their own system, it's encrypted before. So if you and I could have our own Proton Mail accounts and communicate in perfect secrecy. So there are some tools there. It's not something that's easily accessible. You have to go out of your way to get to it.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Once you have it set up, though, I mean, you can basically just kind of let it do its thing, right? I mean, it's really just the setup that's kind of the ass pain.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, and also maintain it. You know, so for example, like on Mac Mail, the OpenPGP tool, like it's not always updated to the latest version of the OS. Sometimes you have to wait to upgrade your OS, so you can actually run your mail encryption plugin. There are some interesting things out there. There's some reasons it's not more popular. There's some other tools that are used. I don't want to go into too much. But there are tools that are used for, they're not necessarily security related tools, but they're tools that are used on the server side to ensure the integrity of messages. And that's primarily around spam And so making sure that, like, the web server that's sent, for, like, if I send you an email from my own personal email server, it could be signed by my own personal email server. That way your email server knows it came from my email server and it wasn't Chad's email server trying to look like mine, right? So there's some means there to ensure, to help with integrity. That's actually in the news right now. So one of the big, you know, one of the things that came out of the 2016 election, and again, we don't talk about politics, but this is relevant, is that when Hillary's emails were released, a lot of that was, there was a lot of doubt cast on some of those emails. And, you know, rightfully so, there was some skepticism applied. Like, what were the motivations of these hackers? Why was this information released? And so one of the common refrains for these emails is like, okay, if there was something that was damaging or looked bad to somebody, you know, it was often referred to as like, just like fake. Okay, it's fake. Like, the hacker obviously made that. Or they alter text or whatever. And there's actually some tools that they can use, though, to verify the authenticity of these emails. And so there have been some security researchers, and there were some papers recently released that showed that these emails were, in fact, at least some of them that were in dispute, were, in fact, genuine. And so there are some things we don't know. We don't know exactly who sent them. Right, we don't know who was like behind the keyboard, but we do know what account it came from and like what email server it came from, and we do know that the email is authentic. So there can be some pieces there. Again, that doesn't address confidentiality, but it does address integrity. And so depending on the circumstance, you know, those two are just as important as one another. So there are some tools in place, but for your average user, email is an insecure format, and it should be regarded as such. So where you and I used to work at the old salt mine, as we say, you know, we had a secure messaging solution. We were able to send emails in a secure fashion. Now, what I will say is that it primarily only protected against man-in-the-middle attacks. So if I intercepted that message, there wouldn't be any way for me to access it without the recipient's credentials. That wasn't a perfect solution, but given like the sort of information we worked with, it worked relatively well. But you know, the inconvenience that was associated with that was substantial, and we fielded a lot of support requests functionality.
It was ridiculous. I don't wish that upon my worst enemies. I really don't.
But, I mean, you know, it's better than that. You know, on the alternative, though, you know, we also use Slack heavily at that organization. And so we certainly didn't want that kind of information going over, you know, going over that medium either. So we had to find something. You know, secure email worked for those instances, but we certainly tried to minimize the point at which it, you know, it was used.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think my last point on email is you just think of it as a medium. It's kind of like sending a letter in a lot of ways, right? We have some control over what happens after it's sent, but like not a lot. What I would say is, though, is that it's kind of like you can send anything you want across an email as an attachment. And so there are ways, you know, if you're interested in sending encrypted information, you know, you can throw it into an encrypted zip file or encrypted disk image and zip it across the net. You run into the same problem we talked about with symmetric encryption, where you have to share a key. So there needs to be some mechanism for doing this. That happens pretty frequently in the IT world where we come from. You know, I'll receive some information in a zip file that's encrypted, and a guy will just text me the password. That works fine. It's two factors. It's not infallible, but you know, it greatly reduces the risk of compromise. So,
you know, two-factor is such an easy concept to understand and pick up, and yet, it just seems like it adds such a gigantic layer of security. Am I wrong, or do you think it's kind of like meh?
Well, I think it's a valid point. It's a valid tool. I think companies need to do a better job of integrating it, right? So I'll give you a classic example. A lot of times when you're dealing with two-factor authentication, it's for services that you may want to integrate with others, with like other applications. So for example, email is like a classic example. So I may want to get email on my phone. So I set up two-factor authentication on the website. So if I go to my mail provider or my own mail server and I log in, I have to enter a one-time access code. Okay, no big deal, right? Not a problem.
Yeah.
But when I want to actually put it on my phone and use the mail app on my phone, it gets a little bit more problematic. And so I have to go into this mail app and I have to go to this place and I have to say, I have to find in the security section where it allows me to create my own application-specific passwords, right? And so then I have to generate an application-specific password, put it in my email app, and that's the only place it's ever used. And I have this other password for logging in with two-factor, and I have this other password for logging in with my phone that I never use. I mean, it just gets messy. And so I think the more that companies work to integrate those solutions more seamlessly, the better off we'll be. A great example is I just turned on two-factor authentication for my Amazon purchases. And so we spend like a crap load on Amazon. And so I thought, well, that's something I definitely want to secure. So I set up two-factor auth on that. And then now I can't get my, I have a delivery tracker app. It's called Deliveries by JuneCloud. Great app. But now I can't get that to work. So again, it's the whole trade-off, security versus convenience. I am more secure. I'm also less convenienced. So, your mileage may vary there.
Yeah.
So email, the problems that come with email are largely structural. It largely has to do with the asymmetric nature of the communication, right? I can email you now and you may not get it till 3 months from now. It comes from, a long history of interoperability between different providers. So the question may be like, so what? So what can we do if we need to share information online? We don't want to set up this, convoluted open PGP email encryption system. We don't want to sign up for these nerdy email services such as Proton Mail or LavaBit. I'm just reading that LavaBit started up business again earlier this year, so good for them. What do we do? All right, so we have some options. The first option, of course, is always, it's the trick one. It's that we don't do anything, right? We just accept the risk that whatever we're going to send, it's not going to be compromised. If somebody finds out about Zach's lizard pictures, right? They're probably not going to use them against him. And even if they did, it wouldn't be the end of the world. You know, whatever, right? Now, some of like for 90% of us, like that's not a big deal, right? It gets a little bit trickier with some documents. Like, I don't want to send my tax return across the net unencrypted. I mean, 99.999% of the time, it's never going to be an issue. But I have enough tinfoil on that I worry about the other times. So, what can you do? Okay, so some options. So, like we talked about, I tend to use a lot of Apple products. I like the cohesion. I like the focus on security. Your mileage may vary. There's issues with it. They're not perfect, whatever. One thing I think they do pretty well is it's pretty well established that iMessage, their iPhone to iPhone, iPhone to Apple product, whatever, communication tool is pretty secure. So Apple provides it with end-to-end encryption. And so you have some means to ensure that your conversations are secure. And so even if, like, my conversation between my wife and myself were cracked, it wouldn't necessarily mean that my conversation with Zach would be cracked. It could be read either. So there are some tools there. That's built into the OS. It's built in. It's a freebie, right? So you can go on there. You can get that done. Other chat services, such as Skype, for example, they're encrypted too. The chances of like some guy at the coffee shop picking up your Skype communication, with your lizard dealer is pretty low.
Thank now the problem, goodness.
For all of us, there's enough of that stuff in there. Now the problem becomes though, what happens if the government gets involved in your dealings, right? Well, the government can go to Microsoft and they can say, hey, here's a national security letter. Here's a FISA warrant that was obtained by a secret court. We want you to spy on Zach, and we want you to not tell him about it. And they're legally obligated to respond.
Man.
It's always the G-man.
It's always the G-man. Son of a...
So a tool like that, I mean, again, you have to assess your risk pattern. Are you more worried about, you know, terrorists from Bermuda, or are you more worried about, you know, your government? I think both have some merits there. But for Skype, you know, if you're just sending, you know, if you're just talking about a security podcast, although I'm sure you and I are both on a list now, you know, you're probably okay. But if you're going to get something a little bit more sensitive, then you probably want a different tool. One thing you got to be careful with these tools, we talked about this briefly, is that any tool that allows you to reset your password and see messages means that they can compromise it. They can always reset your password to something they know go into your account. So Apple has this new feature that's rolling out. It actually got delayed. It was supposed to shift out with iOS 11. It was iMessage in the cloud. I have seen nothing on how that works. I have no understanding of how that works. It doesn't even make sense to me. They have very talented security people there, so I'm assuming they have some solution. Supposedly, it contains end-to-end encryption. But if they can give me access to it when I forget my key, then it's not really secure. So you got to watch out for situations like that. Let's see. So the good news is a lot of these apps, a lot of these communication apps, though, have encryption by default. So a great choice is an app called Signal. So it's by a company called Open Whisper Systems. It's a messaging solution. It's all free. You can do text. You can do instant messaging and voice, and it all uses end-to-end encryption. You can have messages self-destruct, kind of like Snapchat or something like that. You can use it on your desktop with the Google Chrome browser plugin. It's heavily recommended by Edward Snowden. So that's an option. You just get it. It's free. Turn it on. Get your, you know, conspirator to use it, and you guys are going to be encrypted in a way that can't easily be intercepted. So that's about as quick and easy as it gets. There's a tool I like a lot. It's called Keybase. We talked about in our cryptography show. It's a means by which it lets you generate your own private and public key. It publishes your public key. It allows you to, like, it's kind of like a cryptography social media thing. Like, you can pull up my profile. You can see, like, I've verified various domains that I own. I've verified, you know, my Twitter account, my Reddit account. That's all. They've all been cryptographically signed. It would be very difficult to fake that. Keybase offers similar encrypted chat and file transfer capabilities, except it does it in a way that's a little bit more transparent with what's actually happening. And so they also have various tests and proofs. And so if I'm talking to Chad, for example, Chad and I have this set up, I can actually send him a command and force him to prove his identity to me. And so it's kind of like something like Signal, but it's a little bit more, you know, a little bit more verbose, gives us a little bit more data and a little more context. And it might make you a little more comfortable. That's also free. It's under limited beta right now, but I haven't had anyone have an issue getting an invite, so I wouldn't worry about that. Another really popular option is Telegram. So that's very similar. Now, one issue with that is it's tied to your phone number. So that's something you want to think about. I mean, the G-man definitely knows what your phone number is. So,
yeah, and we all know how easy it is to, you know, call up your local provider and pretend that you're somebody else until they just give you a SIM card, right?
Right. So there's some interesting, I mean, there's some stuff there. It would work fine. I wouldn't worry about that. It might actually be easier to, you know, convince your friends. At least you wouldn't have to share, like, you know, your super secret code name. It just based off of your phone number. And I think it even integrates with your address book to some extent, to where, you know, if five of your friends use Telegram, you can, like, begin messaging them right from there. So there is some methods to that, but the phone number is definitely a liability. Let's see. There's a couple others. WhatsApp is probably the big one, though. So WhatsApp was bought out by Facebook, I believe, for like some number of billions of dollars.
Which is insane. That I remember that. That was hugely expensive.
One thing you can do with this, it's really nice, is they actually partner with the folks behind Signal. And so they add the same encryption methods. Now, a lot of these apps, they vary by region. So WhatsApp, my understanding is WhatsApp is huge in Europe. And it's like the de facto like text messaging solution.
I was going to say, I think at this point, I think, doesn't Facebook Messenger, isn't that the most widely used messenger now just by sheer numbers?
Oh, that could, yeah, I don't know. That could be. I certainly wouldn't trust that security there. But yeah, but I mean, I think that, you know, I'm sure you're right. You know, Facebook is just ginormous. I think it's one of the biggest things behind WhatsApp. Now, I can tell you from perspective, like, none of these apps that we talked about would be any use except for, like, iMessage. You know, it requires some, it's a network effect, right? And so you're very likely to use the same solution your friends do. And so if you happen to be in Europe and you have a WhatsApp, you know, network of friends, then you're in business. You have encryption that's relatively easy, transparent. There's actually a means to confirm encryption. It'll actually send a security code to both numbers, which you can compare. It's a great solution, and it comes for free. So the good news is it's never been easier to find some means of secure instant communication. The bad news is, you know, it's very likely that it's going to be segmented. The nice thing about universal and SMS, you know, just text messaging, is it's universal. You can send email to anyone, you can receive from anyone, and the protocol's set up to work. When you start dealing with encryption, it gets much more siloed and difficult to move between platforms. And so it's just, you know, old adage, convenience versus security. So where do you fall in that stack? Briefly, I'll tell you what I do. Like, nearly all my communications are done with an iMessage. It's not perfect. It buys me enough security that I don't have an issue with it. I am careful, though. I don't share, you know, extremely sensitive information over that means. So, you know, pick your poison. But at least you have a lot of choices. 5 years ago, this wasn't the case. So I think we should consider ourselves pretty lucky.
Okay, so Ken, what you're really trying to tell me here, at the end of all of this, really, is if I just want to send day-to-day messages, you know, I don't care, you know, I don't need them to be secure, I can just stick with what I got, you know, right? I can just stick with my IM, sure. I can stick with my text. But the second I want to send something super secure, one-time pads.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly taken it all the way up to 11, for sure. You know, and there's varying degrees down, right? I think WhatsApp is a pretty secure solution.
Really? You think so?
Yeah, I do. I think a solution such as Keybase is a pretty secure solution. I think PGP email or OpenPGP emails are a pretty secure solution. But like when you balance security or convenience versus security, you know, a solution like WhatsApp, if you can get your network to buy into it, or even to some degree iMessage as it's implemented now, I think you have a really reasonable shot. Now, there's a ton of mitigating factors, right? I mean, what's stopping, like, how much do you trust your friend, right? I mean, if your friend is sitting at the police station showing off your texts on a projector, yeah, there's some issues there. So, you know, at some point you have to like start having really paranoid discussions, and it's like to say, you know, the only way two people can keep a secret is if one of them's dead. Right. And so, you know, I think you just have to have that conversation with yourself, with your colleagues, and we're certainly not advocating for legal activity or by any means, but there's information that between my wife and myself that nobody else has a right to know. Sorry, G-Man, right? You can go someplace else, but we're going to keep this between us. And You know, I think that's one of the great things about America is that we have that right to do that. You know, some of our some of the countries in this world, you don't have that permission. England, for example, has passed draconian laws, forces you to hand over encryption keys whenever asked. I think it's a terrible
precedent.
Oh, that's
ridiculous.
And I think it's gonna backfire in the long run.
Yeah.
And
so
I just hope that I hope that this country chooses a better path. But again, like, I feel like every conversation comes back to the whole, like, idea of a trade-off, right? It's true. It's a little cliche at this point. Assess your own tinfoilness and your own security needs and what your activities are. And, you know, pick a solution that works for you. And I guess don't worry about the rest. There's a lot of things here that we can't control. And like Zach alluded to, if you decide that security is your number one priority, go to the Wikipedia page for the one-time number pad and start reading up, and nobody will catch you. I guarantee it.
Wow, you'd put a lot on the line for that.
Well, assuming you do it right. If you do a one-time number pad, nobody will catch you. Everything else has vulnerabilities.
Right.
So, just keep that in your mind, or just don't do evil, illegal stuff, and you have much less to worry about. I was talking to a couple of people I work with today, and they were telling me all about like these crazy things that happened to them. Right, this one lady, who I used to work for, if you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
She was telling me how this, woman and man, like this married couple, drugged her because they were swingers.
Okay.
And like her friends had to like fight them off and stuff. I'm like, that okay? A, that is terrible. I'm so glad that like you're okay. And B, I lead an incredibly boring life. nothing like that ever happens to me. So, I think it just depends on, the circumstances that you, like, put yourself into, your own sort of, like, station in life, like where you find yourself at, and sort of the, risk behaviors you go into. And that's certainly not, that wasn't her fault by any means. I didn't mean to say that, but it's just, different people have encounter different situations. Different people have different probabilities of different situations happening to them. And so, figure out where your optimum level is and try to stay there. I don't mind being boring. I come home to my wife, my kids, pet the dog, like it's all good.
Oh, that's one verb for the dog.
You come home and spend your night petting the lizard, and that's fine. So it's all good, Zach.
It is, Ken. And remember that next time you talk about my lizard.
Different strokes. If you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, there's the long stroke, the short stroke, but we'll stop it there.
Yeah, you gotta pet him. So, once again, we're putting out the call. If you know of an Egyptian Euromastix lizard, I'm not sure to what extent Zach would go to get one, but it would probably be disturbing and illegal. So, if that's interesting.
I'm slowly becoming desperate. So, if you please,
Zach has a void in his life.
Please.
It's a hole in his heart. He needs to be filled
by
a lizard.
It can only be filled by the native Euromastix species of the Middle East.
Yeah, so, I don't know. This is our message in a bottle to those, so. All right, Zach.
Yeah, Ken, I think this is a great subject to talk about. I think we're almost, I don't know about you, does it feel like these subjects are coming to a point where we've got no more to talk about, or do you feel like there's always going to be something, some aspect of our life that we need to secure?
I don't know. It's interesting to see what happens. Security, I think this is going to converge in one or two ways. One where security is no longer an issue because we have it, or one where security is no longer an issue because it's no longer like a viable solution, right? Because everybody will have everything. I don't know which wins. I hope it's the former. I'll tell you that.
I sure do. But we'll see. Maybe people like you can. Maybe people like you and me can help see that future and realize it. And you too, listening on this podcast, Chad.
Exactly. As long as we don't run out of tinfoil, I think we got a good shot.
Oh, yeah. Those factories will produce forever.
Yeah. That's renewable, too. Make sure to recycle, folks. All right, Zach. It's been real. It's been fun.
Yep, it's been great. Ken, I hope you have yourself a good night. And the rest of you listening to this, Chad, I hope you do, too.
Yep, see y'all next week.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.